for April 2nd, 2007 will come to order. We have five matters on for public hearing, and I think what I'd like to do is hear first from, on the county matters, HJR 47 and House Bill 3047. Second, from the diesel emission bill, House Bill 2172, and then at the end we'll hear on House Bill 3048 and 3049. So we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3047 and House Joint Resolution 47. And I do have a summary.
I have somebody on House Bill 3047.
Go ahead, Mason. Yeah.
It's been a while since I worked property tax, but
it happens, huh?
Yes.
Go ahead and tell us you worked the weekend or something, Madison. Get us really whining for you.
Well, it's something that will pay off, Mr. Chase. The House bill in front of you, this is a committee bill, Mr. Chair, and I think it was on the behalf of the counties. It seems like the counties wanted to clarify certain things within the law that exists already. I think some of this law, as I was looking at it, and I verified it with John Phillips from the Department of Revenue, I think some the language that we were dealing with has a leftover effect, if you will. This was left from the days of the serial levies before the Measure 50 type of permanent rate. But then with the introduction of that, I think that the counties, I think especially Washington County, would like to specify and clarify the law that those amounts will be folded within the rates, the permanent rates of the Measure 50 for the road departments of those counties. And I think you would probably, once you, we can have that discussion, and they would see what the examples of what might be a concern on their behalf, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mazin. And do we have a summary on HJR 47?
HJR 47 is made. Would you like that to happen?
Actually, you know what? I'm going to close the hearing on HJR 47. We'll reopen it in a few minutes. I realize as I look at it, it's really on a different topic, even though it's of county interest. Do we have a sign-up sheet for HJR 3047?
Yes, sir.
We do. Okay. It looks like the Association of Oregon Counties and Washington County would like to be heard. Why don't you both come forward? Good afternoon.
Chair Bernhardt, members of the committee, my name is Morgan Cowling with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm here to testify in support of 3047. First, I wanted to describe a little bit about what this bill does. It has two primary goals. The first is to bring sections of the county road statute in line with the 21st century. It eliminates some antiquated language about rural post roads and market roads, and also creates a grandfather clause for a couple of our counties that had serial levies for roads that were incorporated into their permanent tax rate under Measure 50. And it clarifies the ambiguity that exists and allows those couple of counties that fall into this specific category to continue to share revenue with their road department on transportation projects. This is especially important for Washington County, and Sherman County is another county. Currently, Sherman County has about a total road fund budget of $1.5 million, and almost a third of those revenue come from property taxes that are shared with the road department. So for the continued maintenance of those 435 miles of Sherman County roads, this is particularly important. The second section of the bill looks forward. Currently, as county's future is uncertain regarding the forest safety nets, some of our counties may look to local option levies for roads to give them another tool in their toolbox for road funding. I mean, we wanted to clarify that how those local option levies are apportioned under compression. Right now it says no less than 50% of the tax shall be split with cities and road districts, and we wanted to make sure that it's no less than 50% of the tax assessed and levied, so that if you're operating under compression, you're still splitting the levy proportional. The second portion of that allows the counties and the city to develop by agreement how to use those funds in the county. And right now, because it is a proportional split, we want to give them the flexibility to do it on a project basis or to work together to figure out the best ways to spend those money. The last thing to mention is that we have requested an amendment for this bill. Currently in the bill, ORS 382.205 is repealed, and we do not want to repeal that statute. So it's a short little amendment. That's really the overview and description of the bill. It seems pretty straightforward, but it is important to make sure that the counties that do fall under that grandfather clause can continue to share those revenues. I'm going to turn it over to Shelby Rihal from Washington County to talk about the implications of this bill for Washington County.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions, too.
That would be great. Are there questions? I have one. I believe you and I have talked about this already, but refresh my recollection. What is 382.205?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, it actually is dealing with using county road funds for bridges. And in an emergency, the statute says you can use any funds to fix a bridge emergency, and we want to make sure that counties have that in the statute.
So this was simply an oversight in the drafting process.
Chair Barnhart, that's correct.
That's the dash ones, is that right? Thank you.
That is correct.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Shelby Rahala, Government Affairs, Washington County. Morgan did a great job of explaining the technical aspects of the bill. As one of the counties who had serial levies on the books while they were rolled into Measure 50, I wanted to give a little context of how this bill would impact Washington County. Washington County's voters approved three property tax serial levies in 1986, 89, and 95 for property tax or for transportation capital improvements, and those totaled $217 million. In 1996, the serial levy was incorporated under the county's property permanent rate property tax. The Board of Commissioners has oversight to determine how general fund dollars in the counties are spent, and the Washington County Board of Commissioners has determined that it is their wish to continue to uphold the will of the voters and continue to devote those monies to capital transportation projects. Voters gave us this taxing authority, and we feel it is important to honor their intention by continuing to do this. You have a flyer in front of you. The Transportation Capital Improvement Program, correct, yes, in Washington County is the Major Streets Transportation Improvement Program, MSTIP. This has been incredibly successful in the county. As of 2006, MSTIP projects have built 64 projects countywide at a cost of $352 million. So this is a very important program to Washington County, and we would request the clarification and update in the statute clarifying Measure 50 and allowing us to continue expressly to honor the will of the voters and give us this express authority. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for Shelby?
Chair.
Yeah, Representative Butler.
Between Shelby and Morgan both, now that we have you on the record, could you give us some kind of a breakdown, thumbnail sketch of all of the places that counties and all of the tools that counties have at their fingertips to obtain money for specifically for roads.
This Chair. Is a quiz.
Yeah.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Butler, I'm not sure that I could list all of them. Local option levies are a current tool that counties have. Some counties qualify for the special county allotment program that benefits a few of our counties. The forest safety net is not necessarily a tool, but is a funding source.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Butler.
I'm just trying to make sure that what we are doing is that whatever it is that we do, that we continue to add more tools available for counties to have as an assessment tool. And I'm particularly concerned, and I'm still looking under county roads and rural roads, for the rural road assessment districts. And Morgan, that's something that's near and dear to my heart, but it's my understanding that that's a different issue than what we're looking at today. But my concern is that some of these tools, and you've mentioned that these are to clean out some antiquated language from the county road fund statutes, and I appreciate that. My concern is that we perhaps need to go back and open up some of the statutes which previously have benefited rural counties, particularly those that may be affected by ONC, that we open those back up. So while this bill doesn't refer to those, I just want to know from the county perspective, and I think I saw Judge MacArthur here, your exec. He is here. I'd like to know that we're, as much as possible, opening up new tools or expanding those tools which may have previously been closed for some counties relative to the resources that they have available to them for roads, county road maintenance.
And Chair Barnhart, Representative Butler, we think that all of the tools available are important because not every tool is going to be perfect for each county. Each county is going to look at what will work best for the people in that county and the best way to fund their roads. And so the goal of this bill in particular is just to make sure that we're refining and clarifying that one of the local option levy can be used and used well by the counties.
Thank you. Mr. Chair,
Representative Butler.
Out in southeastern Oregon, some of those tools are old and blunt, but we need them in the toolbox.
We're not repealing any tools, are we, in this bill?
Chair Barnhart, I do not believe so.
But
that would not be our intent at all.
Thank you.
I'm anxious that we take a look. Well, we've got a bill before us with the relating clause of relating to taxation for local public roads, that maybe those tools that have been closed off because your county happened to have more than the 15,000 or 20,000 people in it, that was the case back in the late 1800s, that we maybe come back and take a look at some of those things to say maybe a rural road tax assessment district is something that ought to be stuck back on the books as long as we have this instrument before us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Butler. And my comment to that would be, if somebody wants to write an amendment or two and get some support for it, those would certainly be considered at work session.
That's why we've got the chair of the AOC so close to the dais at this particular point.
Yes, I think you've been hinted to. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Butler. Are there any other questions for this panel? Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 3047? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3047. And we're going to open a public hearing, reopen the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 47. And I think Mary has a short summary for us. And we have two witnesses, Mike MacArthur and Don Schellenberg. And if those people would come forward. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House
House Joint Resolution 47 is an Oregon constitutional amendment that permits a county to indefinitely impose an uncertain amount at this point per 1,000 RMV for public safety in addition to and not in lieu of allowable taxes dedicated to government operations other than schools. It defines for public safety purposes and refers the amendment to the voters in the next election, regular election, which would be May, November 2008. I have no estimates, obviously, since that's a blank, but I did put together a couple of scenarios that would be five cents per 1,000 RMV, and since this would go into effect and impact the biennium 09-11, I have some estimates there based on growing total real market value as of 05-06 by roughly 6.3% per year over the next few years until we get out to the 09-11 figure.
Okay, just so that I understand, you've got three possibilities, and these are all, this is a nickel.
Yes.
Per $1,000 of real market value.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. And it's basically taking the $362 billion, raising it to 1.063 to the fifth power times its rate.
And so this is assuming that every county in the state adopted the tax.
That is correct.
And Measure 47 requires that the county does the imposition. This tax is not automatic.
No, not at all. It's subject to local approval.
Great. Thank you. Other questions for Mary? Thank you. Go ahead, gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mike MacArthur, Executive Director of the Association of Oregon Counties. I want to say we appreciate the effort here. We appreciate the concept of giving us another tool in the toolbox. And as we heard in the testimony just previous, that bill indeed does preserve a tool. Here we're talking about another tool having to do with public safety. I have some handouts that are coming around with some information, some of which you may have seen before. It talks about the structural handcuffs that are generated by Measure 50. An example of what happens with property taxes in the case of Coos County, for example, if you added a $300,000 home, it would go on the tax roll at a maximum assessed value of $184,000 because of the changed property ratio, and that would generate because of the county's permanent rate of $1.08, a tax payment of $199 a year. So you can see we're very limited in what we can generate with property taxes in some places in the state. And the chart indeed shows you the variance in rate, which I'm sure you've seen before, from Josephine County to Sherman. And this bill indeed would affect those counties that are in compression or those tax districts that are in compression and give them another tool, which I think is laudable. There's another addition to this chart that I'd like to call your attention to. I think you've probably seen the second and third page. But on page four, it shows graphed out what would happen should the Wyden Amendment carry in its present form. And it shows you the ramp down to 2011 where we fall off the cliff. So all the tools that we can accumulate between now and that time, or perhaps if we don't even get the Wyden Amendment now and next year, are very much appreciated.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Don?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Don Schummelberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. What I have in front of you is two possible amendments. These are not, though they say draft-1 and -2, they're not LC-1 and -2. These are my own -1 and -2s. And I testified before you last week, I believe it was, and this is very pertinent to what Representative Butler was talking about earlier. Y'all probably have an old easy chair in the house, just feels really good. But the spouse said it's time to get rid of that one and get a new one. And it maybe don't quite fit right. You wish you had that old easy chair back. For Representative Butler, instead of just getting some of the old tools back, I'd like to get the old toolbox back, with the tools that are in it. And so essentially what, the -1s would do would take us back to where you have an automatic property tax base instead of a 6% in automatic increase on vote of the governing body. You'd have a 2% automatic, and then give the voters one opportunity each year to increase the tax base if they think that's necessary, and then two opportunities to a year to go outside the tax base, but limit it to 2 years. And this would be under the dash ones, would be for the purpose of safety purposes. Going back to the total concept that property taxes for property-related services is correct, and we should have never left that. And so the dash twos are take a broader view, and so that it would give the county the authority to do the same thing, create a tax base for property-related services only, but create a tax base, 2% increase, and the votes, et cetera. And it would establish the tax base as the average of the previous 2 years' operating costs would be the beginning tax base. So we'll put that before you for your consideration, and thank you for the opportunity to do that today.
Well, thank you. Very quietly, you drop a little bombshell on us. Are there questions for Don? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don, typically, when we look at compression under 50, we see rural Oregon outside of cities are very seldom compressed compared to Oregon's 241 cities. This has the effect of, in effect, bringing back onto the tax rolls, if you will, those cities which presently suffer from compression. But it also shares then the tax burden with all taxing lots. All taxing units in a taxing district or in any particular tax lot in Oregon. Is that seen in any way as being more onerous to those folks in the city over the folks that are rural?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, had not contemplated that aspect of it. I would hope not, just based back on the primary principle again, property taxes for property-related services. Doesn't make a difference whether you're in the city or in the county. If it's a service, a property-related service that's provided by the county, and the cities be part of the county, but if it's provided to the city as well, then the city would be part of the property tax system. But they would also be receiving the service. It makes that nexus between the taxes you're paying and the service you receive. And I think that's a very important philosophy to keep on the books.
Follow up, Mr.
Chairman.
And I don't want this to sound critical in any way, but most of the folks that do not have that are being most of the tax lots outside of a city would be probably subject to some kind of special tax taxation that is taxed based upon production or based upon forest use and those kinds of things. Do you see this as being equitable in its presentation overall, certainly based upon the current tax allocation and I'm concerned again how this would be perceived as on a ballot measure, the folks that would come back and say that the legislature failed to recognize that there are a lot of tax exemptions for certain kinds of rural farming and ranching and other agricultural uses.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, what this does is take property-related services out from underneath Measure 5. Separates them out, puts it back the way it used to be, when the people had the ability and the authority to determine what the tax base ought to be, what the operating budget ought to be for that district, and they had then the ability to determine how much they wanted to spend to protect themselves or pay for roads or for fire protection, police protection, whatever it might be, those property-related services, it gives them the authority back to protect themselves. And that's the problem we have now under the Measure 5 scheme, is this compression that everybody's limited. And it doesn't give the people the right and the ability to protect themselves. And this would do that.
And final question, if I may, Mr. Chair. Really, this it could be seen then amongst those over half of Oregon counties as really an alternative to the loss of the ONC monitoring center under the federal law.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, that's entirely correct.
Thank you.
Do either of you have any idea as to whether a constitutional amendment of this sort would have any chance at the polls?
Mr. Chair,
do we have data on that issue?
We have not polled that specific issue. The only property tax related issue that we polled was the change property ratio, new construction, and sales coming on at market value.
Okay. May I suggest that if you want an election on one of these ideas, that you ought to make sure that you raise it with the caucus leaders across the building, and that you figure out some idea as to which of these ideas, if any of them, might have a chance with the voters. I'm intrigued by all of these ideas. I don't know what the rest of the committee's thoughts are about them, but I'm intrigued by these ideas, but I don't want to put an issue out to the House leadership or the Senate leadership that they can't support, and I don't want to put an issue out to the people unless we have a pretty good idea that they're likely to support it too. So if you're interested in this one, I'd suggest you have some work to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We appreciate those comments.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Does that raise any comments from anyone else?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Two things. First directed to Mike. Mike, I would like to know that we can open up using this former bill an amendment to make certain that we could open up the rural road districts for a reexamination for those rural counties. I think we've discovered that it's an impossibility that, under the way that it's defined now, that folks can go ahead and build rural roads or build themselves for rural roads using tax basis under the old rural road district, because I think the last of it went off in the 40s or 50s of the last century. But secondly, Mr. Chair, and I think the and give me the correct term if you would please, Mary. It's the property ratio. What's it called again?
Change percent ratio.
Change percent ratio. I think that the change percent ratio probably and there's Coos and Curry County, and I think we've heard from those counties. I think the change percent ratio is something that probably borders on unconstitutionality now. I think that it is an unintended consequence which confers a benefit on new property which was never intended and probably as I say borders on being illegal the way that it is finally implemented. I can't remember which county it was that supplied it, and I'll be happy to provide a copy of it to you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. But my specific question was, can you show me what the difference is? And I think it was Curry County that sent it to me, and it said a new home coming on the roll comes on at such a low rate that it actually distorts the whole property tax system, and we don't have the one property $1 aspect anymore. These properties are coming on at such a strange ratio that it actually is prostituting the entire system of property taxation in the state, which again, I think it was Don McIntyre that came to us and said, wait a minute, 47 it was intended to do this, 50 it did this, and now you've got it to a point where it is out of whack. And again, it uses these old property ratios, the
original permanent rates mm-hmm. that were part of the system, which now we're looking at with regard to public law, but the change in the public law with the ONC. My concern is that if we do not do something and give the voters a chance, that we're still going to be looking at a circuit court and then a Supreme Court challenge to Measure 50, that the system is broken and it's prostituting the values that are expected for new homes and residences.
Representative, you're talking about an attack on the current statutes or an attack on the constitutional amendment itself?
On the constitutional amendment itself, I think that it's actually, and we found, I believe, and it isn't germane to this current issue, but we found also that properties under the deferral for historic values, as they're coming back onto the tax rolls, all of the value which they had deferred for the time that they were deferred is being charged to them and more as a penalty. And again, what's happening is that the system is so out of whack that I think it's subject to challenge, and I think that those challenges would prevail, and eventually we would have a constitutional challenge with regard to 5 and 50, which could then invalidate not the entire theory, but certainly some of the outcome. So I think that it's really important that we address these issues, and these may be the vehicles.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman, if I
yes,
may make one
Ron.
Final comment
yes,
that relates
please.
To the Dash 2 that I put before you. Just remind you that pre-Measure 5, we were financing schools primarily with property tax, and it's my belief that's what drove Measure 5, because property taxes for schools in addition to property-related services were driving the property tax high. And if we were to come back and just do property taxes for property-related services, I do think, and I have no polls in this regard, but I do think the public would be receptive to that change, so that would give them the ability to, again, protect themselves and provide for the services they need.
Thank you. Appreciate it. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Joint Resolution 47 today? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 47. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2172. And I've got everybody here today, huh? Okay.
Potpourri
Day. Chris will give us a summary then.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2172 comes from the Energy and Environment Committee. It does a number of things. It directs the Environmental Quality Commission to establish a goal to reduce the risk of cancer from diesel engine emissions to no more than one case per million by 2017 and to substantially reduce risks to school children by 2013. It also directs the Environmental Quality Commission to establish standards for qualifying repower or retrofit diesel engines, including a 25% reduction in diesel emissions. It establishes the Clean Diesel Engine Fund, a permanent Department of Environmental Quality appropriation to provide grants and loans to assist owners to repower or retrofit diesel engines, to scrap older diesel engines, and to fund administration of the Clean Diesel Program. It dedicates 75% of the funds available until June 30, 2010, to repower or retrofit vehicles that will be used in Oregon for 75% of their total miles or 75% of their total hours in the 3 years following the retrofit or repower. It authorizes the DEQ to certify and contract with third parties to repower and retrofit diesel trucks. With respect to taxation, it extends the current diesel engine credit for low-emission truck engines for engine model use through 2011, and it also creates a new credit for up to 50% of the certified cost of a qualified engine retrofit or repower. The maximum amount of the credit taken in a year is 50%, and it's either the tax liability or 50% of the taxpayer's liability, excluding refundable credits. The language isn't entirely clear on that piece, but I believe that's what it's trying to get at. The credit may not be used in conjunction with the pollution control credit, but it can be used in conjunction with the residential alternative energy credit or the credit for an alternative fuel vehicle fueling station. And I believe the overlap there with the RETC would be the alternative fuel vehicles. The credit applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2007, and allows a three-year carry forward and a transfer to another taxpayer. And there is no sunset on the current credit. And by way of background on the existing diesel engine credit, the tax expenditure report shows an estimated impact of $300,000 for the current and next biennium. And in 2005, about 70 taxpayers on the personal side claimed a total of $110,000 in credits and were able to reduce their liability by about $85,000.
Thank you. I have one person who signed up to testify who has a scheduling problem. Other than Oregon Trucking Association, is there anyone else with a scheduling problem? I'm going to take him out of order. Bob? You're supposed to be in two places at once, as I understand it.
Unfortunately, that's the case. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. And I wanted to testify before you today in support of House Bill 2172. As many of you are aware, the on-highway or the trucking portion of the diesel engine users in this country have been marching down a path to clean up our diesel engines, the emissions from our diesel engines. In 2004, we dramatically reduced the NOx emissions. Last year, we went to ultra-low sulfur diesel, which got all the sulfur out of the emissions. This year, we went to a particulate trap that reduces 95% of the particulate matter that comes out of the exhaust of a diesel. And then in 2010, we have one more drop in NOx. And the diesel engine guys tell me that in 2010, certainly in urban areas, the exhaust coming out of on-highway diesels will be cleaner than the air going in, so we're going to route that exhaust into the cab of the truck for the benefit of our truck drivers. But there are some areas where we still need to do a little bit more work. One of them is carbon dioxide, which is a global greenhouse gas that contributes to global warming. You've already seen House Bill 2110, which is the renewable fuel bill, and that's what that does. Biodiesel does not emit any carbon dioxide, so that's very positive. Sort of the other sort of universe of engines that we need to talk about are engines that are older, that we're still using, and off-road engines, and those kinds of things. And that's what this bill does. It basically deals with the older engines. Diesels last a very, very long time. When our on-highway guys get rid of them, they sell them to a local trucker. When they get rid of them, they sell them to a farmer. When they get rid of them, they sell them down in Mexico. So they really do last a long time, and we need to address that. And that's what this particular bill does. There's a number of features of this bill that we like a lot. Number one, it's a very cost-effective approach. It requires the Department of Environmental Quality to do a cost-benefit analysis to determine how they're going to authorize tax credits, grants, or loans so that they're paying the least amount of money for the greatest reduction in emissions. It's also a very flexible approach. It has a number of tools to provide as incentives, but it also is flexible in the technology that they can use. So we're anticipating that as time goes on, there will be new technologies that will help us clean up these diesel engines, and the bill is flexible enough to allow DEQ to employ those new things as they come into the marketplace. It's a very innovative bill. To the best of my knowledge, there's no state of the union that has come up with a solution to dealing with the very oldest diesel engines. If the diesel engine was manufactured prior to 1994, it can't be retrofitted because it doesn't have electronic controls. So there is a provision in this bill that would allow DEQ to buy up those old diesel engines and recycle them and get them out of use entirely. This also has a business delivery or service delivery model that we like a lot, and it takes advantage and leverages the private sector. From our perspective, the way this will work is the diesel engine folks that we deal with every time. My guys are playing golf during the week and doing all that kind of stuff with them because they're selling us engines and they're selling us service. It will be these very same people that will market the retrofits to us. So we'll be leveraging that marketing ability that we already have in existence. Once they talk with us, then they'll go back to DEQ. They'll get approval to do the retrofits. Then they bring our trucks in or off-road equipment or what have you, and they will put the retrofits on the vehicles or on the engines, and then we'll go away, and then they will build DEQ for reimbursement, and it'll all be done. We've used this business model in other areas, and it's proven to be very, very successful. This particular bill will be of tremendous benefit to all Oregonians. It will dramatically reduce the emissions from diesel engines and improve the health of all of us. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions, and I want to thank you very much for taking the time to listen.
Thank you. Questions?
I just have one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, as the bill comes to us, engrossed in Section 2, it talks about that the goal is to reduce the cancer-causing particulates. Who reports on the science and the actual... does the study to show that engines in Oregon will drop down to less than one per million?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, the Department of Environmental Quality is required under the bill to track the emissions and to report regularly to the legislature.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. And we will have some testimony on the health issues from the agencies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions, trucking related, to Mr. Russell? Thank you, sir. We
thank
appreciate
you
your
much.
Testimony. And now we'll get to those, the Public Health Division, the Governor's Office, and the DEQ. Gentlemen.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave Antoff, and I'm from the Governor's Office. And I'm going to be very brief and then turn it over to DEQ and DHS to talk through a bit about the specifics of the bill and the benefits that it provides. But I just wanted to share with the committee that, as I did with the Environment Committee, that this is one of the Governor's priority bills. He's been focused on the diesel emissions area for a number of years for a couple of reasons. One being, as Mr. Russell indicated, this is one of the areas where we can do some work, still do some good work in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, which has been one of the key focuses for the Governor. And it's part of his overall global warming strategy to figure out ways that we can make an impact and reduce emissions in Oregon. So this takes us a significant step forward in that respect. And then it also has great environmental and public health benefits that will be talked about by some of the range of stakeholders that are supporting this bill. It's one of the nice pieces of legislation where we've got a very broad range of folks supporting the bill because it really is going to benefit our economy and our environment and our communities in a real significant way that people understand. So with that, I'll leave my testimony off, be happy to answer any questions, and turn it over to Andy Ginsberg from DEQ.
I have one that I think is peculiar to the Governor's office. Is this item in the Governor's budget proposal?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, yes, this is part of the Governor's. In the Governor's proposed budget, this was funded at a $3 million level, and that's been adjusted, as I understand, in the co-chair's budget. And Andy will talk a little bit about that as well.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, and I'm pleased to be here today to urge your support for House Bill 2172A, which is an important element of the Oregon Clean Air Initiative to reduce air pollution from diesel engines. As you heard, this bill will create a variety of incentives for diesel engine owners to reduce emissions from their trucks and other engines. It was adopted or passed unanimously by the House Energy and Environment Committee and subsequently referred to you. As Bob mentioned, diesel engines are very important for the economy. Diesel engines move 94% of the freight in our country. They're very powerful. They're durable. There's really no replacement for them. And they have one problem, which is older engines are high emitting. Those emissions can contribute to a variety of public health problems, on which my colleague from DHS will expand upon. But just briefly, asthma, cardiovascular disease, cancer, and then also contribute to environmental issues such as global warming, as Dave mentioned, and also haze. The particulate emissions from diesel engines are one of the top toxic air pollutants in Oregon. 25 of 36 counties in Oregon are over the health benchmark set by the Environmental Quality Commission, and the average Oregonian is exposed to risk of cancer 13 times over that benchmark from diesel engines. Fortunately, we have a great solution available. New technology is now available to make diesel engines very clean. In fact, these engines can be as clean or cleaner than compressed natural gas engines. And EPA is requiring new engines to be, as Bob mentioned, new engines to be much, much cleaner, so that the engines rolling off the assembly line for on-road trucks this year have the particulate traps on them. They have 95% reduction in particle emissions. And in 2010, as Bob mentioned, nitrogen oxide emissions will go down. Also in 2010, EPA will require non-road engines, non-highway engines, such as construction equipment and farm equipment, to have the same technology. So on the new side of things, the federal law is going to take care of it. The problem is that these engines are very, very durable, as Bob mentioned. They'll be around for 30 or 40 years, and we have this huge legacy fleet of high-emitting engines. That's what this bill is targeted to. So the point of this, the whole purpose of House Bill 2172 is to give us the tools to reduce emissions from the existing diesel engines and speed up the public health benefit that we'll get from the new technology. I'll just really briefly run through the sections, and I'll do this very, very briefly, and if you have questions, I can come back to that later. Section 2 establishes a goal for the bill. This is very important because it allows us to measure progress. The Environmental Quality Commission set a health benchmark for diesel engine exhaust, and this bill sets a goal to try and get to that benchmark in 10 years. So that gives us something concrete we can track progress against year to year as we're implementing the bill. Sections 3 and 4 focus on schools, and that's because children and drivers are exposed to very high levels of diesel exhaust both inside the buses and outside of the buses. And what this bill does is help schools compete for federal money that's available to reduce emissions from school buses particularly. It corrects a glitch in the current law that does not allow the local school districts to use money that they spend from the state school fund as match against federal grants. So in other words, this bill will allow school districts, if they choose to spend money on retrofitting their school buses, to use that money as match and get more federal grants. Section 7 through 11 create the Clean Diesel Fund, and this is focused on providing grants to retrofit and repower and scrap and reduce idling emissions from existing diesel engines. As Dave mentioned, the governor's budget includes $3 million for the fund. The fund would be available for highway and non-highway engines, and it would only pay for the incremental costs of reducing emissions over normal costs, less any tax credits or other financial assistance that's received. And only, as Bob mentioned, only cost-effective projects would be approved. So the fund is focusing on getting the largest emission reductions per dollar spent. Perhaps more relevant to this committee, sections 12 through 16 establish a tax credit to engine owners to encourage them to reduce emissions from their existing engines. It is only available for those who are going beyond regulatory requirements and actually spending some of their own money to reduce emissions from these existing engines. So it encourages private investment. It also helps engine owners in Oregon compete for federal grants, because the more match money you can put on the table, the more likely you are to be successful in competing for these federal grants. So this tax credit allows them to actually spend more money and be more successful in getting federal grants. The credit covers half of the cost, the qualifying emission reduction cost for retrofits and repowers. It can exceed the taxpayer's liability, although it can be carried forward for 2 years. And it includes a pass-through feature, which is modeled after the business energy tax credit, and that allows a non-tax-paying entity like a local government or a transit district to take advantage of the tax credit by passing it through or selling it to a tax-paying entity. Section 17 through 22 extend the sunset for an existing tax credit that was adopted in 2003 to encourage truck owners to buy new trucks. And the reason this is important is that as EPA comes out with new standards, the new trucks are going to cost more. Also, the first couple of model years, people may be hesitant to buy, just like all of us would be hesitant to buy the first model year of a new car. And so we're expecting there to be a little slump in sales of new trucks as the 2007 standards go into effect, and then again in 2010 when those standards go into effect. So the purpose of this is to just get the truck owners over the hump. The existing statute was adopted in 2003, and it sunsets this July. This bill would extend the sunset to 2011, and the existing tax credit ranges from $400 per engine if you have 100 or more engines in your fleet, up to $925 per engine if you have 10 or fewer engines in your fleet. So as you can see on a $100,000 or a couple $100,000 truck, it's not going to cost someone to buy a truck that otherwise wouldn't, but if they're holding back, they're ready to buy a truck, and they're holding back just because of the extra cost of the emission reductions, this would get them over the hump. And then in terms of measures, we will be tracking the number of engines that are retrofit, repowered, or scrapped. We'll be tracking emissions. The Department of Environmental Quality does a comprehensive emission inventory from all emission sources, and we will be tracking that to see the reduction that we get from this bill and from federal requirements. And also we'll be looking at risk, and that's the goal in the bill is established that reaching the health benchmarks which are set in terms of risk, so we'll be tracking that as well. So in summary, this bill creates a variety of incentives to reduce the emissions from primarily from existing diesel engines, and I urge your support, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. I think we'll hear from Dr. Lehman next, and then we'll go questions for everybody. Thank you.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Richard Lehman. I'm a medical epidemiologist with the Oregon Public Health Division at DHS, and I'm here today in support of House Bill 2172. This bill would reduce diesel emissions by promoting the retrofitting, rebuilding, and replacement of older diesel engines. Diesel emissions pose a serious public health problem in Oregon, particularly for those with asthma, heart disease, and chronic lung disease. Often, some of Oregon's most vulnerable residents suffer the greatest risk. And exposure to diesel exhaust is associated with increased numbers and severity of asthma attacks in children as well as in adults, and children living in high traffic areas are actually more likely to have impaired lung function. Exposure to the tiny particles in diesel exhaust increases the risk of death among those with heart disease and lung disease, particularly those age 65 and older. Several recent studies also show a connection between ongoing exposure to diesel and to the particulates it contains and lung cancer. Contact with diesel exhaust is common in Oregon due to the widespread use of diesel engines in trucks and construction, agriculture, and so on. Current federal guidelines require that new diesel engines meet strict emission standards, but they don't provide incentives to reduce emissions among older vehicles, as would House Bill 2172. I'm here in support of this bill because the reduction in diesel emissions from existing engines that would result would decrease the risk of death and acute illness among Oregonians with asthma, heart disease, and emphysema. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Berger.
A couple, if I may.
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair. I think it was answered in your testimony, but this goal to reduce excess lifetime risk of cancer due to exposure to diesel engines seems pretty, I mean, it's a laudable goal, but measuring it gets tricky. But you indicated that you actually measure diesel separate from any other pollutants that might also cause cancer. You get where I'm going?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger, that's exactly right. We measure the amount of emissions, diesel emissions that come from all different types of engines in Oregon. And then we calculate risk using computer dispersion models, and actually a lot of the work is done by EPA once we in the states collect the information and submit it. And they calculate what the exposure is to diesel exhaust by county for the whole country. And then based on the exposure, we look at people's living patterns and how much they make, you know, if they're school children or if they're working, what their typical patterns are and how much they get exposed to, and that gets translated into risk. So we actually do have specific numbers, and that's backed up by monitoring. Our monitoring is fairly limited, but we do actually monitor toxic air pollutants in Oregon as well. And so we check that against the modeling to make sure it's about accurate. And yes, we do intend to be able to measure this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That reassures me, because when I first read this, I said, how could they possibly monitor and measure this, but clearly they already are. My second question, and maybe it's my confusion as to how this actually works, this tax credit. You, Doctor, indicated that the feds don't have any kind of a matching way of getting money for this, and yet you testified that there might be federal matches in there. So either the feds are helping or they're not in this. And maybe it's just my confusion as to how it works and where the federal match might be.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger, the federal government does have funds set aside to assist states with reducing diesel emissions. And some of the money is specifically targeted towards school buses, and some is more available for different types of engines. But they have an office that's really promoting this approach rather than regulating existing engines, but instead providing grants and other types of incentives like tax credits. The federal money doesn't come to states, though, automatically on any kind of a formula. Almost all of it is competitive grants. And in most cases, the more local match you provide, the more federal money you can bring. So one of the things this bill does is it enables Oregon to compete better for the federal grants. There's no guarantees that we'll get it. But we did include federal dollar limitation in the bill, because we expect to do very well. And Oregon has gotten some federal grants already, but this will really enable us to step up and compete with some of the other states like California and Texas that really have large programs that are competing for the federal dollars.
Paula?
Yes, explain to me who exactly qualifies? Is it DEQ gets the match? Is it the local school district who gets the match? Who's competing for these? And how many federal dollars are we talking about on a yearly basis or granted nationwide? I mean, do we have a chance for anything more than, I mean, a $100,000 grant isn't going to go very far in this, you know.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger. There are a number of different grants that fall into different pots, and so depending on the specific grant, different entities may be the specific grantee. For example, under the transportation bill, there's a program called congestion mitigation and air quality, and Congress recently allowed diesel emission reductions to qualify for those CMAQ funds, and that comes through the Department of Transportation and through the local metropolitan planning organizations, the cities and the counties. So in that case, they would be the grantee. In other cases, like the Clean School Bus program, could come through DEQ. More likely, it would come through the Department of Education, or it could come through specific school districts. And so on and so forth. We the states in our associations have, together with the diesel coalition nationally, have asked Congress for $50 million to fund the Diesel Emission Reduction Act, which is the central federal program for that's aimed at helping programs like what we're trying to do in 2172. And I don't know what level Congress will fund it. In the past, it's been funded at less than that amount. And we all know the federal budget is in trouble as well. But there's a lot of interest in funding diesel, and so we're anticipating there will be significant dollars in the federal level.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've had testimony about this being included at a certain level in the governor's recommended budget and in the co-chair's budget. Are those two amounts reconciled, particularly with regard to the revenue impact study that's been produced by LRO?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Butler, I don't believe they've been reconciled yet. My understanding is the co-chair's budget has reduced the amount that would go into the program. I haven't seen the document that you're referring to, so I don't know how that affects it. I don't know if Andy can add to that, but there is not a fully reconciled difference right now.
Mr. Chair, sometime before we finish up today, perhaps we can spend a few minutes on that. The second question I had was with regard to and this probably Andy, heating oils, diesel one in Oregon, do we have the same kinds of reductions and or filtration controls on heating oils that we're imposing on diesel two for use in these kinds of engines?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Butler, that's an excellent question. I'm not sure I can fully answer it. The technology that EPA adopted for new engines does not apply to furnaces and heat, boilers. Those are subject to different types of requirements. If they're industrial and commercial size boilers, they'll be subject to NuSource performance standards under a different title of the Clean Air Act. So they are regulated at least for commercial industrial size boilers. The fuel quality is also regulated, but it's a pretty different program, so I can't really answer your question. I can get back to you, though.
Please, Mr. Chair.
I think that would be a really useful thing for us to get some additional information on. Thank you, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A follow-up, if I may, then with regard to the heating or the oil standards, this bill comes to us via a couple of different committees, one of which was the Transportation Committee, and Representative Reed sits on a Transportation Committee. That unfortunately is not here to hear this testimony.
Representative Reed, unfortunately, is ill today.
My hope is that we'll be able to get sufficient testimony into the record relative to one of the things that has been brought out in the Transportation Committee. In that committee, we've talked about the high amount of I think the first testimony that was offered by you, Andy, was that 94% of the United States freight moves across with these diesel engines. However, Oregon is unique, and I don't think that 94% of the freight in Oregon moves by trucks. I think that there's, because of the Columbia River, clear up to Lewiston and Clarkston, as well as the at-grade railroad, the one and only east-west at-grade railroad up the Columbia Gorge, on both sides of the Columbia Gorge, as well as the coastal sections servicing the Pacific Rim, Oregon has probably a much greater access to third world country diesels. And my concern is that I understand that both the railroads as well as the Columbia Gorge traffic uses a much, much higher grade of sulfur containing, which would be a lower grade of diesel, and that on the coastal side of it, that actually along the coast that you actually have almost a waste oil, a diesel oil, which is almost in an unrefined state. It is probably a high-grade crude in some respects. How are we going to address that? And that looks to me like that's at least as much of a problem for the areas along the Columbia River, along the railroads that serve the gorge on both sides of the river, as well as the coastal communities in Oregon.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Butler. First, the bill does address all types of diesel engines. So, for example, the barges, the diesel-powered barges that go up the Columbia, the diesel-powered trains are all covered by this bill. So to the extent that we rely more on those types of transportation than on-road trucks, we're still addressing the right problem through this. Although, as I said, the federal standards for the non-road engines don't come into play until 2010, and I believe that shipping and trains are even a little bit behind that. But we will be working on all facets of the problem. Specifically with regard to the fuel, the ultra-low sulfur fuel that's now available for on-road highway use has 15 parts per million maximum sulfur in it. The fuel that's used by non-road engines has much higher sulfur, but the standard for that will come down in time for the 2010 standards, because the new technology, just like you had to have unleaded gasoline to have a catalytic converter in a car, you have to have ultra-low sulfur diesel to have a catalyzed particle filter on a diesel engine. So in 2010, when the federal standards apply to the non-road engines, then the ultra-low sulfur fuel will also be available in that market. It's a lot of it's available now because it just depends on distribution networks how it's getting out there. But by 2010, we'll have required on-road and non-road at the ultra-low sulfur. Now that doesn't cover the marine application you were talking about. There, we're subject to international treaties, and we have a little bit more challenge. There is an effort, though. There's a provision called a sulfur emission control area, and there's a coalition of Oregon, Washington, and California, along with British Columbia, requesting EPA to, through international negotiations, establish the West Coast as a sulfur emission control area, because we have so much of an impact of diesel emissions from international shipping that uses very low-grade fuel and comes into our waters and then traverses up the coast and can cause greater impact than local emissions. So it's a very significant issue that you're raising. It's not one that we can address on the state level other than to advocate, as we are, that EPA do this through international negotiations.
Mr. Chair, that's a segue, if I may.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. Andy, that's a great segue to the efficiency of the diesel engines. When we went to the catalytic converters and low sulfur, there was an efficiency issue. With the filtration systems that we're presently employing, and the electronic components and retrofitting and so forth, are we actually losing power and efficiency, or are we compensating for it as we're pulling out the sulfur and substituting whatever it is that provides the horsepower?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Butler, my understanding is there is no efficiency loss. It must be compensated. The studies that I've seen that my staff have shown me, they do test whether fuel economy goes down when trucks are using these filters, not using these filters. And I'm sure there's some variation depending on specific models, but overall they're saying no loss in efficiency. And I wish Bob was still here, because he would, I believe, say the same thing.
Thank you. My final question,
yes,
Mr. Chair, is to Dr. Lehman. Dr. Lehman, thank you very much for your testimony, particularly as it relates to lung cancer and the greater lung cancer risk due to diesel tube particulates. My concern would then be, is there any study relative to people who work in the diesel industry, truck stop operators, truck stop employees, folks that work in diesel repair, or just truck drivers, greater levels of cancer among those folks? I always, and this is going to sound really strange, but I always enjoyed the last stop of the day when I was younger, and touring for some work responsibilities in Mexico, that the last stop of the day was at the transfer station for all the buses, and that wonderful diesel smell made me always think my day is within an hour of being over. I'm on my way home now, and now I think back, you know, everybody that was at that, 10,000 people an hour, I'm sure, that were at that transfer stop, you know, we're all subject to high risks of cancer. Is this something that we've got some statistics on, Dr. Lehman, relative to high rates of cancer amongst truckers or other people that are around these engines?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Butler. There have been several studies which have drawn this association between levels of particulate exposure and lung cancer. I do not remember one specifically that was done in the trucking industry.
Mr. Chair, I need an explanation on that, because we're making sure that this, through several sections of the bill, we're making sure that this is going to benefit children. Do we have any evidence that children being exposed to these higher rates? I guess the fact that Mom and I took the kids to school in the car versus letting them go on the bus, our children are healthier than the children that were on the bus?
Well, Representative Barnhart and Representative Butler, my reading of the literature shows me that there is an increased risk of asthma, for instance, asthma attacks, both the number and severity of asthma attacks that is associated with periods in which there are higher levels of particulate matters. I don't know that someone has done the study to track people who ride the bus and people who and kids who ride the bus and kids who do not ride the bus, and to attempt to draw that sort of comparison. However, the literature does support an increased problem with asthma attacks in children due to increased levels of particulate exposure, such as would be found in diesel.
Let me follow up on that very briefly. I'm not certain from this question and the answer whether we're talking about particulates that are located immediately near the exhaust from a diesel engine, or whether we're talking about particulates that are more generally in the atmosphere as a result of diesel engine use in the area.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in the upper Willamette Valley between the hills, air gets pretty stagnant in there, and I'm wondering, are we talking about youth right next to an engine or somewhere else?
Chair Barnhart, we actually are talking about ambient exposure in a number of these studies, so it is not a situation where someone is right next to a bus or a diesel engine. These are actually levels that can be measured in the general air in a particular region, as DEQ currently does, and in some situations these have been tracked. It's been possible to look at whether rates are higher or lower, and in situations when they are higher, that has been associated with increased risk of acute problems like heart attack among people who have pre-existing heart disease, and it also has been associated with increased problems with asthma.
Thank you.
Yes. Could I add to that,
yeah,
Chair Barnhart? The one thing that might be confusing is that diesel exhaust contains fine particles, and we are concerned about fine particulate more generally from other types of sources besides just diesel engines. But we're particularly concerned about diesel particulate because of the toxic chemicals that adhere to the surface of the little particles. The particles end up basically being delivery mechanisms to bring those toxic pollutants into your lungs. So they have the problems of the general problems of fine particles and how those can affect your health, but also they deliver these toxic chemicals to your lungs as well, and that's why we're concerned, in addition to asthma, about lung cancer from diesel exhaust.
And Chair Barnhart, if I may add to that, in this setting, because these particles are so small, they bypass our usual methods for filtering, and so they can get right down into the lungs. They can lodge in the lungs, and they can also be transmitted across the lung wall into the bloodstream, and when they get into the bloodstream, they can have an effect on, they can produce inflammation, which is one of the reasons that they are associated with an increased risk of heart attack and with asthma.
Thank you. Do they cross the placental barrier?
Chair Barnhart, I am not sure that they do.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thanks. It seems like we're pretty far from the revenue.
We are.
Since we're in that territory.
Thank you. And thank you for the reminder. We are getting we're getting far afield, and I assume those issues were raised in the other committees.
But I'm curious, is there any interaction between benzene and diesel that's been so well publicized as having a huge rate in Oregon?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Rosenbaum, I would say no. Benzene is associated with leukemia, blood cancer, and diesel particulate more with lung diseases and heart disease. There could be some interaction. I don't know, but I think we're thinking of them as pretty separate problems. One's primarily benzene is in gasoline as opposed to diesel.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. One of the things that this committee has decided to do in our rules is to require that every piece of legislation that extends tax credits or establishes tax credits include in some form or another, not necessarily in the bill, a statement of the purpose of the measure. And I see you've got that in Section 2 of this bill. But then we've also added to that a specific set of measurements that can be used to evaluate whether that purpose is being met or not. I think it would be very helpful to the committee in the processing of this bill if the DEQ or others who are going to be responsible for measurement could bring back several ways in which we can measure the efficacy of this tax credit that we're talking about, and whether what difference it made and what that means, and perhaps you could also check with the epidemiologist and see what that means in terms of how you could measure what that might mean in terms of human illness and things of that sort. Have I captured the idea in that suggestion, Representative Butler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excellently, probably for staff. We're talking about a specific gamut of truck engines right here today, but we've also said, yeah, but in the future this is going to apply to, and it's going to help us in these regards, and we're working on an international study and outreach because of our coastal areas, and unfortunately in Oregon, or fortunately as the case may be, those coastal areas go clear up the Columbia River and into the Willamette confluence. And so I think that I would like to know from a fiscal standpoint, you know, how far reaching this may be, so that we'll be able to kind of anticipate what other kinds of things that if we offer an incentive today to drop the particulates in a certain kind of post 1984 engine, then what does the future look like for freight trains, for barge traffic, and for international shipping lines, those kinds of things. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative. And that actually anticipated my next question, and it's somewhat related to this, and maybe another way of talking about it is, what are the states around us doing, and what effect does this bill have on through traffic? We have lots of traffic that moves from California to Washington or Vancouver, and what about the issues that Representative Butler raises related to the same general topic?
Chair Barnhart, I can give you an initial answer to that, and Kevin Downey of my staff is here to testify also a little later today, and he has a lot more detail if you want to really delve into this. But I lost my train of thought. You remind me where we were.
Having to do with the
California, Washington, right?
Right.
The California and Washington and Oregon have worked together, entered together into a coalition to work on diesel emissions, just like we have on climate change issues. And California has a very large program in the order of, I want to say, $140 million per year funding for diesel retrofit activities. Washington is a little bit ahead of us. They've been, I believe they've already retrofit their entire school bus fleet, and they're now moving into their other types of engines. And they have a bill this session also to extend their program along the lines of what we're doing. So we're very much in step with what's happening, in California and Washington, and particularly because a lot of the on-road traffic is up and down I-5. applied in all three states, it's really important that we work together.
Thank you. Does that generate other? Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
I would just like to comment that I never cease to be astounded at what Representative Tom Butler knows about things like diesel engines and fuel standards.
And here we thought he was an accountant.
And here I thought he was an accountant, not a diesel mechanic.
Thank you. Let's see. We have several more people who want to be heard on this bill today. I'm going to take them in the order they're here because I can't see any particular advantage to any other order. Kevin Downing and Mary Ann Guest. And how about Ralph Groner?
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Downing, and I'm president of Ask Me Local 3336, representing the employees of DEQ, and I'm proud to do that, but actually I'm also in my day job. I'm the Clean Diesel Program Coordinator for the department.
Ah.
Here urging your support for House Bill 2172A.
So do you have two hats on today?
I have a couple hats.
Okay.
Which one? Yes. I'm very stylish that way. So diesels, in fact, are a workhorse in the American economy, but there's also been always been an issue with the diesel exhaust. Representative Butler's reminisces nonetheless. They're typically regarded as a nuisance because of the smoke and the odor component of diesels. But it's actually more than that, as you've heard testimony earlier, that they're also implicated in cancer, increased risk for cancer, cardiovascular risk, asthma, and actually even global warming. And up until a few years ago, there really wasn't much to be done about that, but the advances of technology have made it possible for diesel engines to operate as virtually as clean, if not cleaner, than those powered by compressed natural gas. And so what we've seen, though, is that there are regulations being adopted at the federal level which are bringing those technologies into place into the engines that are coming into the market these days. And that's great, but for the fact that waiting for that natural change to occur means that we have to wait 20 or 30 years for the benefits of that technology to come. And the basic premise of these efforts have been is that Oregonians shouldn't have to wait for that. And through our efforts in the department, we've been working in a program that we call the Oregon Clean Diesel Initiative, which is basically, very simply, it's three elements. Burning a cleaner fuel, either an ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel and or biodiesel, burning fuel cleaner, that is, with retrofitting exhaust control devices on existing engines, and actually burning less fuel, looking at and promoting technologies and techniques that reduce idling, for instance, or identify other more efficient technologies that can be applied where diesel engines have been put into place already. These technologies are effective. They're actually very beneficial. I think to go to Representative Butler's questions earlier, there have been studies that have indicated that have documented the health effects, have not only looked at workplace exposures, which as you might expect, where concentrations are especially high that people might get sick from this, but actually even at the levels at where there's ambient levels, that is where you and I are going about our day-to-day business, that there's sufficient impact and risk from diesel exhaust to warrant concern. The projects that we've been implementing so far are very cost-effective, typically returning 10 to 1 in terms of avoided public health impacts for the dollars that have been invested so far. So far, in Oregon, the estimate of the annual impact associated with exposure to diesel exhaust is around $2 billion a year in terms of total public health and environmental impacts. And through our efforts so far, we've delivered about $19 million a year in benefits, which is a good step, but certainly not enough to simply to get us to where we want to go. So through your efforts, you can help us be part of this effort as well, but with your support of House Bill 2172. And we do this really on behalf of all Oregonians, but I keep in mind, too, in particular, some who have contacted me over time, like the woman who worked for the Dallas, Oregon Fire Department, who had to quit her job because of an increased sensitivity that she developed to diesel exhaust exposure from the fire trucks that were working in that station, as well as the gentleman in Gresham, who is battling throat cancer right now, who worked on diesel engines all his life, has never smoked, but thinks that that the exposure to diesel exhaust, in fact, was the contributor to his throat cancer. And we can provide definite benefits in a very well-defined way through your help and urge your support for 2172A.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Marianne Guest, representing Oregon School Employees Association. I'll just go down. Am I loud enough?
And we could hear you before, too.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. The goal of the bill is to reduce diesel particulate matter in Oregon to the health benchmark adopted by the Oregon Environmental Quality Commission within 10 years. But for school districts, for school buses, it would be to reduce, the goal is to reduce them, the particulate matter within 5 years. This is particularly important for children who spend a lot of time in school buses and actually take in more air than adults do. I'm not sure why, but they do. And this can create quite a problem for them. Currently, now we're going to get into some of the numbers, which I hate to throw a bombshell, but it is a bombshell. There are approximately 5,750 school buses on Oregon roads transporting over 284,000 Oregon children to and from school each day. And approximately 80 to 85% of those use diesel. Of those buses, approximately 1,370 buses were manufactured prior to 1994 and cannot be retrofitted adequately to protect Oregon school children and meet the 2007 federal standards on emissions. Nor do the buses meet current fire safety standards adopted by the federal government. Replacement of these buses is a health and safety issue that cannot be ignored. The approximate cost for a new school bus is $80,000. Newer buses not only will meet federal standards for emissions, but also meet the new safety standards the federal government adopted in 1994 after a series of tragic school bus fires. New safety features include more exits and fire retardant seats. Also, newer buses can significantly reduce maintenance costs for school districts operating student transportation systems. The remaining 4,000 buses can be retrofitted, the ones that were manufactured after 1993, can be retrofitted to reduce particulates by about 95%, and the cost is about $6,000 to $7,000 apiece. Total cost for those buses would be about $22 million to $26 million. Total cost to replace the 1,370 school buses manufactured prior to 1994 will be approximately $100 million. And we would ask the committee to prioritize replacement of public-owned school transportation systems first, which would cover approximately 1,000 school buses on the road today. That would be particularly if Beaverton has 75 buses manufactured prior to 1994, North Clackamas has 72, and Salem-Keizer 65, and Hillsboro with 44 pre-1994 school buses. And this is clearly a health and safety problem for Oregon's children. There are also several studies, this is an additional problem, several studies that measured fine particulates and black carbon inside diesel school buses. In-cabin concentration inside buses was four times higher than in passenger cars that were tested beside the bus. Exposure during bus commutes were 50 to 200 times greater inside than when loading and unloading children. For $1,000 each, a bus could be retrofitted with a closed crank case ventilation system, which will lower pollutants inside the bus. As you know, the Oregon legislature in 1991 passed a law or developed a law to provide 70% transportation reimbursement for school districts. In addition, you provide 10% a year for 10 years for bus replacement costs. This is money that can be leveraged to purchase new buses. Unfortunately, in our research, though, we found that audits do not check that districts are, in fact, spending bus depreciation funds to purchase buses. This needs to be corrected to assure compliance for the health and safety of Oregon school children. House Bill 2172 helps by encouraging school districts to compete for access to other money. As you heard before, the president has requested $50 million in grant money for diesel retrofits in the U.S. this year, and in 2008, the request is for $35 million. The bill also sets up a clean diesel fund in Section 10, funded with general fund dollars. As you heard, the governor allocated $3 million in his budget, though the request was for $14 million. As I've shown, the cost is high, approximately $100 million for retrofits and replacement of publicly owned school buses that cannot be adequately retrofitted to meet the goal of the bill. We will need to pursue additional funding sources to ensure school buses meet health and safety standards. And one of the places I would alert the committee to is school districts can use bonds for this purpose. It's not commonly used, and we should be encouraging school districts to go out for bonds to purchase new buses. Oregon's Constitution mandates education for our children. As an extension of that, transportation has been is an extension of that mandate. We appreciate your support for putting healthier or cleaner buses on the road and increasing the health of our children. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Groner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner, working for AFSCME, American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. My statement will be, believe it or not, much shorter in that I've worked on this project for about a year and watched Kevin Downing, my president of one of my 175 locals, teach me and Andy Ginsberg teach me, and we've gone to about 40 legislators door-to-door in the first 3 months, so I guess I feel I have a right to testify because I've worked with this team exceedingly hard, and it's been my top priority for the following reasons for tax purposes. If we're here today to talk about the validity and the efficacy, using your terminology, Mr. Chair, of a tax credit or of a program, it seems to me that this, in fact, is the tool chest. This is the very foundation of the group that has been working on a coalition called the Oregon Clean Air Initiative. We won't get into those because some of those will be coming in front of you. But the fact of the matter, this is the first bill I have seen of this magnitude. This is the environmental health measure of not only this session, but quite frankly, well, I would hope you would look with pride and realize this is the big one to face you for many years to come. And as to a tax credit, was my job during the Oregon Transportation Improvement Plan when we saw the transportation plan was in trouble. We, in fact, inserted the $3 million because the truckers were going to oppose the measure at the time. And the results were rather negative in the fact that that money really wasn't used. And my only reason for raising that is it's my belief and others, since this is the one bill of this session where all of labor, all the environmental groups, all of business, including the general contractors, the truckers, and the other business associations with diesel, farmers, ag is with us, and the fact is government, not one group has opposed this measure because it's without a fact can the return on the investment. The governor put $3 million in. That's the same as we started with in 2003. And we were going to ask the legislature to see if we couldn't get more because EPA has matching grants. Of course, the Department of Energy has grants, et cetera. So the fact is that this is the environmental health bill of the session. My largest local, OHSU, with 5,000 members, has in fact OHSU and now all the other hospitals in Oregon have passed a clean diesel zone. So you retrofit to trucks coming to deliver in those hospital zones. I only want to say that for every dollar we contribute to help offset the health costs, which is the number one issue to organized labor, is the rising cost of health The health group that's looking at health cannot escape the fact that environmental health is in fact a major contributor to health care costs in Oregon. And when we talk a very small tax credit and contribution from the General Fund of Oregon to compete with $110 million per year health costs due to exposure to these particulates, $110 million, and we look at the $2 billion over the 10 years, and we have a goal of by the year 2017 reducing cancer from the current 13 per thou, I may have that number wrong, down to 1, you will see that this, in fact, is not only a major health issue, but from a tax perspective, this probably makes the most sense of any tax credit that I have seen in years and years, because it helps us reduce the cost of health care due to environmental pollutants. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. May I say that particular comment is very germane to the issue of whether or not we ought to grant a tax credit. Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Butler.
Just one. Kevin used the estimated return to society 10-1, and I was looking for that in your testimony as to where that may have come from. Perhaps you could share the source with us, Kevin.
Well, actually, there was an independent study done by a group called the Clean Air Task Force in Boston, but actually, even looking at the work that we've been able to do so far, actually, I was just looking at my notes, we've been able to secure about $3 million in federal grants over the last several years for diesel work. From that has leveraged about another $6 million in other funds from other sources within the state, so that's about $9 million so far in diesel projects. And as I say, that's resulted in, by my calculations, about a $19 million annual benefit. Now, the 10-1 aspect of that, that's $10 million to get $19 million. That's not 10-1. But actually, these projects have generally a five-year or longer useful life. And so at $100 million with a $10 million in, we're easily at 10-1.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. That's very helpful. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony today. Lindsay Capps, Oregon Environmental Council.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify before you here today. For the record, my name is Lindsay Capps. I'm Legislative Director for the Oregon Environmental Council, and like the other panelists you've seen up here today, we strongly support House Bill 2172. This bill, we believe, will go a long way in both promoting clean air and contributing to better health outcomes for Oregonians, especially our children. As was testified to by Dr. Lehman, diesel exhaust has been linked to lung cancer, upper respiratory illnesses, and death from heart and respiratory disorders. There are about 40 air toxins released when diesel is burned, many of which are carcinogenic. In addition, a number of studies have linked diesel exhaust to low birth weight, premature births, and increased risk of birth defects, in large part because diesel contains mercury and lead, cadmium, among other toxics. And as has been noted, diesel soot is a particular concern as an asthma trigger, especially for vulnerable populations and children. Children who breathe more air pound for pound of body weight compared with adults are especially at risk. According to the Department of Human Services, over 333,000 Oregonians suffer today from asthma, and that includes nearly 58,000 children. So this is a major public health concern. As was referenced in earlier testimony, exposure of diesel exhaust is widespread in Oregon, with diesel particulate matter exceeding health benchmarks in 25 counties. But even in counties where ambient air concentrations meet DEQ's health benchmarks for diesel, people live and work near concentrated sources of diesel exhaust, highways, construction sites, and are exposed to unsafe levels. These and other exposures to diesel exhaust harm our health and our pocketbooks. Examples of costs that are borne by everyone in Oregon are rising health insurance costs, costs to employers and to taxpayers associated with respiratory and cardiovascular hospitalizations, lost work days, premature deaths triggered by diesel pollution. Our neighbors to the north estimated that the direct and indirect costs of childhood asthma triggered by environmental contaminants alone cost Washington State nearly $50 million each year. We can reduce these exposures and get at the associated costs by providing incentives for diesel engine owners and operators to burn cleaner fuels, purchase new cleaner engines, retrofit older engines with pollution control equipment, burn less fuel by reducing idling and properly maintaining their engines. We believe HB 2172 gets us off on the right foot by providing the grants and loans and tax credits to do these retrofits, rebuild or replace diesel engines, and to reduce diesel idling. And we are especially supportive of focusing these dollars on the cleanup of Oregon school bus fleets. School buses are among the dirtiest vehicles on the road in Oregon today. And because many of these were manufactured before 1992, produce far more pollution than newer models. And this piece is particularly important when it comes to the health outcomes for children. As has been mentioned, the governor's budget proposes $3 million for this program in the next biennium. We believe, as others do, that this just scratches the surface of the problem. To enable Oregon to reach the goal of reducing the risk of cancer from diesel pollution to 1 in a million by 2017, we believe the legislature should appropriate $14 million for this cleanup. And we're joined in this conviction by the American Lung Association, the Oregon Asthma Program, the Learning Disabilities Association of Oregon, the Oregon Center for Environmental Health, and Oregon's Physicians for Social Responsibility. So, again, I thank you for the opportunity to testify today, urge your leadership in supporting 2172 and providing the adequate funding to make a real dent in this problem. So happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Capps? Thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony very much. Are there others who would like to be heard on House Bill 2172 today?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Capps mentioned that this bill has grants, loans, and tax credits. I'd like to have LRO bring us back the information about what all of these are, and then, as has also been indicated and requested by yourself, Mr. Chair, that we also get a reconciliation with regard to the GRB versus the co-chair's budget. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Additional questions occur to me as we've been talking, and these have to do with the tax credit issue and the enforcement issues. I'm not sure who to ask, so I'll throw it out there, and perhaps somebody can be working on this issue. Most of the witnesses are still in the room. One of the questions I have is, how long does a retrofit last? Are we going to be responsible for buying it more than once on an old engine that's going to last for 35 years? If somebody's ready to answer that one right now, you could do it right now. What's the enforcement when somebody's done the retrofit and the repairs are needed, that sort of question?
Chair Barnhart, these are catalytic devices, and so if you harken back to your high school chemistry, and is that catalysts actually energize a reaction but are not consumed in the process. These devices, under normal wear and tear, can last 600,000 to 700,000 miles, so they can be basically fit for the life of the vehicle. And as to your other question in terms of enforcement as to whether they're maintained on the vehicle or not, that's actually will be up to the operator, and we could look at enforcing that through periodic audits of the folks that we've given the grants or tax credits to make sure that they're still in place and operating.
But there's nothing in the bill about that now, about that issue.
No, not specifically, right.
It occurs to me we're talking about spending some money to help people install equipment that's designed to clean up the air. When the equipment wears out or when it fails or needs repair, what happens? That's really the question I have, and it doesn't sound to me as though that issue has been thought through clearly at this point. And, of course, for this committee's purpose, the issue really has to do with did we get our money's worth for our tax credit? And are we going to be on the hook for another tax credit when they go to correct the deficiency later on?
Right. That's something that we can consider and actually come back with a proposal to satisfy the committee's interest on that, I'm sure.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Other questions? Thank you. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2172. Now, there are two other bills on our agenda for today. And because we're out of time, we have 2 minutes until the time I've agreed with the committee that we're going to adjourn. I think that the best approach we can do is to carry them over till tomorrow. And the people who are signed up to testify, I hope, can be here tomorrow. I'm getting a nod. That's great. I appreciate it. So we're going to carry over to tomorrow the hearing on House Bill 3048 and the hearing on House Bill 3049. And with that, our agenda being exhausted, the committee is adjourned.